This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle issue 178, the end of an era, the final Bugle with Times Online, the last ever Bugle until next week, when we will be back with Bugle 179. I'm Andy Zaltzman in London, where I will still be next week with another Bugle, albeit not with Times Online. And in New York City now and forever, amen, it is John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Well, this is it, Andy.
Yep.
As you say, the final Bugle with the Times. The final Bugle in its current form. It's been 178 episodes of fun. What a roller coaster, Andy. What a ride. We've had ups, we've had downs, and now the roller coaster car has come to a stop and we're all covered in bullshit. It's like we should have had a sign outside the roller coaster saying, you must be this emotionally mature to go on this ride. It's been a good run, Andy, in the same way that a man who runs a marathon in a full rhino costume in 11 hours has had a good run. It's been long, it's involved a lot of swearing, it's been stupid and overall completely pointless. But it's been a good run, Andy. Good run. We've come up just two Bugles frustratingly short of you having the ultimate dart score Bugle. It's such a shame we couldn't make it that far.
Yep. Well, but I'm 2 weeks, John. I mean, are we going to restart the numbering? That's the.
I don't know.
It's going to be Bugle 2.1.
That's a discussion to be had.
Well, that's I guess that's probably in the hands of the lawyers. Now, in other words, my wife.
Andy, I've tended to start all these Bugles with a little story, maybe an anecdote about the stranger things that have happened to me over the week. I think I might have a fitting one for the final episode. Last night, Andy, I met Dolly Parton.
Awesome.
It was like meeting a cartoon character. You forget that Dolly Parton actually exists in real life as an actual human being. You can forget that she isn't just an idea, a walking doll, someone from a different time. It's like a waxwork from Madame Tussauds walking up to you and introducing herself. It doesn't make any sense. And to have that tiny icon in the same space as you is incredibly strange. For a start, she wears a spectacular amount of perfume. She walks in a permanent cloud of sweet air so that you can smell her before she enters a room and long after she's left. So much perfume, I think she actually lowers the amount of available oxygen within a 20-foot radius of her, which is presumably why you feel so lightheaded around her. She looks nothing like a woman in her mid-60s, or indeed anything like a woman at any age, and sounds nothing like it. It's like she's lying about her age through all five senses. And it is hard to absorb that the person standing in front of you is not a Dolly Parton impersonator, it's the actual Dolly Parton. And she's one of the most confusing people I've ever stood in front of. It makes no sense to see her in the flesh. Partly, I suppose, because right from a little boy, I've presumed with, I think, justified confidence that I would never meet Dolly Parton. Our lives were never supposed to cross, however briefly. And the fact that I've now done that just throws everything into question.
I mean, how are you going to rebuild yourself from here, John?
Well, I don't know, Andy. I guess it's square one again. It's like the Bugle next week. Everything's been wiped out. I've now got to just reconstruct a life from the shattered pieces of the life before.
Was there anyone else you thought you'd never meet that you still haven't met? Because you've met most people now, haven't you?
Well, yeah, but Dolly Parton was probably right at the top of that list.
Yeah.
Dolly Parton, Andy.
Yep.
Dolly Parton.
Joan of Arc for me. She's the one I'm least expecting to meet.
Dolly Parton, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, that is a fair point. That is a fair point. She's distractingly pneumatic as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, Bugle 178, as all mathematics fans amongst you would no doubt tell us, is a square-free number in mathematics terms. And this is a square-free podcast. We are seriously hip, big-time hip. So hip, we are borderline pelvis. Is that how it works? And for this historic final Times Online Bugle, John is wearing a special Stella McCartney wetsuit with a gold-encrusted snorkel by Bulgari. And Chris is wearing his trademark high-visibility tabard stolen from a motorway workman. And I am dressed as Dolly Parton. The ultimate of all coincidences. Was I dressed as Dolly Parton earlier in the week? That's the question. 178. Also the same number of episodes as Diagnosis Murder that we've done with Times Online. And with equally plausible plot lines and dialogue. And 178, of course, the number of times that former Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev made his KGB head Yuri Andropov stand on a swivel chair and sing the classic 1968 Ohio Express hit single Yummy, 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 I've Got Love in My Tummy, but replacing the word love with communism and any instances of the word loving with Lenin while spinning him round at dizzying velocity and saying, you look silly when you sing. 178 times he did that. Which explains why Andropov didn't last very long after he finally took over, after Brezhnev's prolonged death. We're recording on Friday the 13th of January 2012. Now, there's a series of coincidences here that's just absolutely mind-boggling, John.
Okay.
227 years ago today, 13th of January 1785, according to Wikipedia, a little chap called John Walter published the first issue of the Daily Universal Register. 3 years later, little John Boy changed the name of his newspaper to, any guesses, The Times. Other sources suggest that he actually published the first issue on the 1st of January 1785, including News International's own website. But let's run with Wikipedia. I think they've proved themselves the more trustworthy source. And now, in the ultimate of all ironies, on the selfsame day as he first published his newspaper, its greatest ever audio newspaper offshoot is satiricasting its final Times episode. 227 years back to square one. Also 102 years to the second since the first public radio broadcast. Some opera singers belting out some chops from the Metropolitan Opera House in New York. That's 1411 Broadway, John. That's literally yards away from where you're recording today's Bugle, isn't it?
Yes.
How many yards?
I don't know, Andy. What? A handful.
A handful.
It might be quite a big handful.
Quite a big handful of yards. Also, 70 years to the day since the first use of the ejector seat in a wartime test in Germany. So what better day for The Times to eject its half-New York-based broadcast. And all this on the 50th birthday of country music's Ludwig van Beethoven himself, Trace Adkins, the auteur of the poetic Meistersmash, Honky Tonk Badonkadonk. It's like history woke up with a hangover this morning and cured it by whacking itself in the nuts with a crowbar. That's the only way of putting it.
Top story this week, nuke news! Give me an N! Give me a U, give me a K, give me a stop what you're doing right now or America will bomb you back into the Middle Ages. Andy, it is only natural to sometimes wonder how close we are to complete Armageddon. You can go back and forth on whether we're frighteningly close or reassuringly far away. You might walk in the park and see children playing happily on the swings and think, everything's going to be fine. But then you might turn around and see children trying to set fire to a squirrel and think, everything's going to be really bad instead. It's hard to quantify exactly how close we are to self-destruction. Or is it? Because the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists have announced that they've moved their doomsday clock, a symbolic gauge of nuclear danger, 1 minute closer to midnight because of inadequate progress on nuclear and climate issues. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and their complete bullshit clock have attracted attention for this scientifically meaningless piece of effective PR catnip before, when they moved the clock back a minute in 2010. And that was such a simpler time, Andy, 2010, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Don't you yearn for those innocent days again?
I do. I mean, just things, the world still had optimism then.
Yeah, but
and now we're basically just on the verge of annihilation.
But interestingly, how has the world become more dangerous since then? Because Bin Laden was alive in 2010. How is a world without Bin Laden in suddenly more dangerous than a world with him? Was he just a misunderstood hippie, Andy? Or was he the spectacular Cliff Foxtable that everyone thought he was?
Are the two mutually exclusive, John?
I don't know.
I mean, he might have been a hippie with a few anger management issues.
Mate,
if he hadn't been a hippie, imagine how bad he could have been. I mean, that kept him in check, if anything.
That is a sobering thought. Jayantha Dhanapala, a member of the BAS Board of Sponsors and a former UN Undersecretary General for Disarmament Affairs, quite a CV, said that while Russia-US nuclear relations were improving, others left much to be desired. He said, the failure by the US, China, Iran, India, Pakistan, Egypt and Israel to act on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and by North Korea on a treaty to cut off production of nuclear weapons material continues to leave the world at risk from continued development of nuclear weapons. Wow, Andy. Jayantha must be a blast to sit next to at dinner parties. You had better get ready to spend the entire evening jabbing a fork into your own hand under the table. The world is at risk from continued development of nuclear weapons. That's great, Giantha. Do you mind passing the potatoes and then lightening the f*** up, please? What's that, Giantha? You got a joke for me? Sure, why not? Hit me. I don't know, Giantha. What did happen when an Iranian, an American, and a Russian walked into a bar? They failed to come to an agreement on nuclear disarmament and the world slid ever close to the precipice of annihilation of humanity. Okay, Giantha, I'm moving chairs now. Please do not follow me.
So it is 5 to midnight now. Initially, when it was first set up in 1947, the bullshit clock was 7 to midnight. So 2 minutes per 65 years closer to Armageddon. So that means that's midnight and the end of the world is set for the year 2174 at that rate.
Okay.
So we're off the hook.
We're off.
We are off the hook, people. We will all be as dead as a medieval peasant by then. Every single one of you will be as dead as a nut. Of course, the Bugle franchise will still be going strong. J. Hoagie Oliver VI and Pope Zaltor I still gagging it up big time for the world. But at least we're out of the picture. I mean, we could probably even stand a bit more nuclear brinkmanship from the likes of Iran. It keeps the crowd entertained. The closest the clock ever got to midnight was in 1953, mm-hmm. when the clock struck 11:58. And its nuclear cuckoo popped out and said, kaboom, only kidding, too soon. And that was when the USSR and the USA both blasted the living f***ins out of thermonuclear devices within a few months of each other. Then it looked like humanity, having done so much to wipe itself out in the first half of the 20th century, was intent on finishing the job. 2 minutes of midnight on the doomsday clock. In 1960, though, the clock was set back to 11:53, then in 1963 to 11:48, despite the fact that 1958 and 62 were the years with the most nuclear tests in history. And in 61, Tsar Bomba, the world's biggest ever thermonuclear firework, that was blasted off. So it does seem that we need more nuclear testing. That is a way. I mean, we've really backed out of that. The Tsar Bomber, 50 megatons, it was 1,400 times the power of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs combined, 10 times the power of all the weapons used in the whole of the Second World War, and it produced a mushroom cloud that was 40 miles high. And I do hope the scientists watching that thought, I think that's probably big enough.
Shall we stop now? Well, you can't argue with a clock, Andy, that's the point.
To put that in perspective, John, how big that bomb was. If that bomb had exploded in the same room as reality TV ubiquitiser Simon Cowell, whilst Cowell was looking at himself in the mirror, he might have noticed it. I'm just showing how we can be commercial for any investors out there. Next week, what is Kim Kardashian up to these days? So, but the clock showed mankind was safer, as if the world had realised, no, it's fine, it's just dick swinging, it's nothing to worry about, it's boys' toys, although admittedly the boys are megalomaniac politicians and the toys could destroy mankind. But it'll probably be fine. The safest ever time on the Doomsday Clock, John, was 11:43pm. That was in 1991. I don't know if are there any plans to backdate it throughout history to see... I mean, that's that asteroid that smashed the dinosaurs up big time.
Yeah, that might be a smart idea.
Yeah.
That must have been pretty close to midnight at that point.
But 11:43 in 1991, after Gorbachev had glasnosted and perestroiked the shit out of the Soviet Union, the Berlin Wall had crumbled like a guilty digestive biscuit in an aggressively handled 1970s police interview, and the USA and the Soviet Union had blushingly asked for each other's autographs on the first Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, which restricted their nuclear arsenals to a barely noticeable 6,000 nuclear warheads each.
Oh, it's so close to not having nuclear weapons, that, isn't it?
That's right. But it seems, John, that they're 11:43 then, and now we're back to 11:55. It seems that mankind as a species is simply not genetically programmed not to want to f*** itself to the precipice of Armageddon. That is just the way God made us, as the Bible can testify. And the Lord made Adam in his own image, and he was pleased. But then he thought to himself, wait up, I think I'll give this lad a dangerous self-destructive streak just for a laugh. I should make this new planet a bit more interesting. The last few I've made have been lovely, but so boring without the people and them spending most of their time trying to kill and or hump each other. I'm not making that mistake again. This is going to be a quality watch, unmissable. And when I'm done, I'm going to kick back, crack open a few years and take it easy for a few thousand years. Oh, hang on, I'll just give Eve some norks. There we go, even better. Oh, yeah. Well, I think we can rule the tablet out of the running for potential future Bugle hosts.
So, Andy, how do you combat the destabilisation of deadly nuclear proliferation? Well, Iran nuclear scientist news now! You kill people, Andy. That seems to be our best guess at the moment. Kill people. You bump people off like B-movie baddies. Iranian nuclear scientists have been dropping like flies who were covertly assassinated by Mossad over the last few months. In fact, just this week, Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan, who worked at the Nanats uranium enrichment facility, had two men on motorcycles attach a magnetic bomb to his car during morning rush hour and then detonate it outside a university campus. He died along with the driver of the car. Iran immediately pointed the finger straight at Israel and the US, who in turn gasped in disbelief that Iran could ever think that they would do such a thing, only just stopping short of pulling out an Elizabethan ladies fan and swooning on the speaker's podium. In fact, National Security Council spokesman Tommy Viator said the United States had absolutely nothing to do with this. We strongly condemn all acts of violence, including acts of violence like this. Going on to say, sorry, I take that back. I did not mean to say including awesome acts of violence like this. What's that? I didn't say awesome? Oh, good, because I was deliberately trying not to say that. It wasn't easy, Andy, for him to pull a somber denial like that off, as I'm fairly sure there was a leftover party popper streamer hanging off his shoulder from the celebration party for the dead scientist news that had just been held in the Situation Room 20 minutes before.
But Israel is being slightly less good at camouflaging its glee at these matters. On Tuesday, an Israeli general by the name of Benny Gantz was quoted as telling a parliamentary panel that 2012 would be a critical year for Iran, in part because of, quotes, things that happen to it unnaturally. I mean, might as well have said that while smoking a massive cigar, whilst two massive goons in dark glasses behind him chewed gum aggressively before knocking a vase off a shelf and saying, comprende.
Iranian Vice President Mohammad Reza Rahimi said on state TV that the bomb attack would not stop progress in the country's nuclear program before diving for cover and squealing when a car backfired outside. I mean, he's right, Andy. It might not stop progress in their nuclear program, but it is sure as shit going to make it harder to make progress in terms of convincing people to want to work there. Good luck with that situation's vacant job posting, Andy. Nuclear scientists needed to work in the nuclear program of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Must have ability to enrich uranium for energy and or nuclear weapon, and also have the ability to dodge relentless assassination attempts from the CIA or Mossad agents. Must have degree in nuclear physics and black belt in jiu-jitsu. Previous job occupant died in a car bomb. This kind of job performance will not be tolerated again. Good sense of humour required, no Jews. Incidentally, that last sentence was not a joke.
Well, that's true, isn't it? If we have learned one thing this week, then it has to be careful where you take a WAS. And really, if in doubt, just hold it in until you find a urinal or somewhere without dead bodies in the way. But there's another thing we've learnt. It's that if you're a conservative leader announcing you're going to clamp down on executive pay, there is a danger you'll be viewed not so much as the boy who cried wolf, as the boy who's been feeding tasty scraps of prime steak to the wolf for years before letting the wolf out and saying, look out, folks, little fangy Frank has built up a little bit of an appetite. But if there's another thing we've learned, John, it's that being a top-level nuclear scientist in Iran is not all glamour, particularly if you're not assassination-proof, as you suggested.
Iran, in response to this, announced this week that it has begun uranium enrichment at the Fordo nuclear facility, at which point all Iranian nuclear scientists really should have been instantly checking underneath their cars. And this was clearly intended as a slap in the face to the US. And the relationship between Iran and the US has reached a new level of tension in recent weeks. You build a nuclear facility, we're going to kill your scientists. You kill our scientists, we're going to close the Strait of Hormuz. You close the Strait of Hormuz, we're going to increase sanctions. You increase sanctions, we're going to build another nuclear facility. You build another nuclear facility, we're going to kill another one of your scientists. Okay, we get it. You push each other's buttons. The US and Iran are like Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall in all those old movies. Sure, they squabble a lot, and they may even give each other a slap on the face occasionally. But deep down, you suspect that all that tension comes from the fact that they really want to bang each other. And when it comes to the US and Iran, perhaps in a truly explosive sense, they literally want to bang the shit out of each other, Andy, with some of the loudest bangs that mankind can ever create.
Hitler, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton all over again, but more so.
Now is not the time for Iran to be calling America's bluff over this stuff, because when it comes to US presidential years, tread carefully. This is literally historically bang season. A US intelligence expert from Georgetown said that with little other basis for criticizing President Barack Obama's foreign policy successes, including the completing the withdrawal from Iraq and eliminating Osama bin Laden, all of the Republican candidates except for Ron Paul are trying to outdo each other in sounding bellicose about Iran. The candidates, Andy, are basically ripping their shirts open, oiling up their chests and flexing their muscles whilst desperately suppressing the temptation to acknowledge how ironically homoerotic that is. Rick Santorum, in his debate this last week, said of the Iranian assassinations that he hoped America was behind them. And he's also said in the past that, on occasion, scientists working on nuclear programs in Iran turn up dead. I think that's a wonderful thing, candidly. And bear in mind, this is coming from a man who is strongly pro-life, Andy. That's how strongly he feels about this.
Pro-life, unless it's out of the womb, in the traditional Republican manner. The Pentagon has denied they were involved in the motorbike assassinations. A Pentagon spokesman claimed it was merely a particularly spicy hot chili sizzler pizza, rather than the covert program of targeted killings. Just to be on the safe side, the Pentagon has advised all Iranians just to order plain margaritas from pizza delivery boys for the next few weeks, just to be on the safe side. And in other nuclear news, the president of the Royal Society of Chemistry in Britain has claimed that evil villains in James Bond films have cast a long-lasting shadow over the image of nuclear power. He claimed that the popularity of Dr. No in 1962 created a lastingly negative image of nuclear power as something that could be wielded by dangerous megalomaniacs with aspirations to world domination. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I don't think the blame can be pinned solely on Dr. No for that. I think the Cuban Missile Crisis might have had something to do with that as well. And even if it is the case, you shouldn't be blaming Bond. You should be blaming declining standards in the human brain. If people are prepared to take their nuclear science from a spy movie.
Are we sure the man who said that is an actual professor, Andy, and he didn't just buy that title from the internet? Or are we absolutely sure that it wasn't his 12-year-old son who had hijacked his email somehow and released a statement about James Bond?
I don't know, but I look forward to seeing his lecture to NASA about Moonraker.
Well, that's enough about talking about a chaotic nation that's pursuing a nuclear weapon, Andy. Let's talk about a chaotic nation that already has one. Pakistan update now! And if there was any doubt, Andy, in Iran's mind as to whether or not they should push on and get a nuclear weapon, Pakistan is the perfect example for them. Because there is absolutely no way that the rest of the world would tolerate Pakistan's constant bullshit, or not even merely tolerate it, fund it, were it not for the basement full of bombs that they have somewhere. A nuclear weapon is basically a ticket into platinum membership of the Act Like a Dick with Impunity Club. And the membership benefits in that club are phenomenal, Andy. Whenever anyone questions your dickish behaviour, just flash up your membership card and watch them apologise back away and write you a cheque. A nuclear weapon is the ultimate bargaining chip, the ultimate life insurance plan, and the ultimate national status symbol. In fact, Andy, if you had a nuclear weapon, do you really think that the Times would be dropping the bugle? Do you really think that this would be the last episode with them? That conversation would have been completely different. They'd have told us they were cutting us off. You'd have smiled, tapped and then gently stroked the nuclear warhead lying on your lap, and they'd have backed away and guaranteed us another 100 years. It's your fault, Andy. At no point over the last 177 episodes have you pursued that literal get-out-of-free technology. You shouldn't have been writing jokes. You should have been enriching uranium.
Well, I mean, I have been trying, John. It's just whenever I try and do it, I end up writing puns instead.
I've got some scuds in my garage you can borrow.
Enough. That's early 90s talk.
Pakistan's Prime Minister, Yousuf Raza Gilani, has said that his parliament must choose, quote, between democracy and dictatorship in a vote of confidence in him that's happening on Monday. And I think the problem with that, John, is that most parliaments, when given that choice, would probably go for dictatorship if they thought they could get away with it. It's just so much easier to get things done and you don't have to worry about re-election. You can really see why so many politicians end up swinging that way towards the end of their careers.
Well, Pakistan has always prided itself as having the stability of a man carrying a tray of champagne flutes across a rope bridge during a tornado. But it's got wobbly even by its own jiggly standards recently.
This week, you've been spending too much time with Dolly Parton.
This week, the military in Pakistan publicly rebuked the Prime Minister, warning of serious ramifications with potentially grievous consequences after he criticised military leaders in a media interview. And the chilling part of this is that the Pakistan military tend not to issue empty threats when it comes to their own leaders. And right on cue, the Prime Minister left for Saudi Arabia, supposedly for a family wedding, but certainly a very convenient family wedding. And it might have been a very last-minute RSVP from the Pakistani Prime Minister. Sorry for the late reply, but I would absolutely love and badly need to attend your wedding this week. I wasn't sure I could make it, as things have been very busy here, but it turns out that a window's opened up of me desperately needing to get the out of this country. What a happy coincidence. Please let me come. I really need to come to this wedding. Looking forward to hopefully seeing you there if I don't get killed before then. Joke. Just kidding, not a joke. See you on the big day. I'll be the one surrounded by bodyguards. P.S. Please let me come to your wedding. Seriously.
Well, just hope he had a plus one. Of course, the Pakistan military have not always been the most restrained military in terms of not seizing power in coups, historically. And I think running Pakistan can be safely described as a tough job, kind of up there with being Mugabe's international PR officer or being Indian cricket captain. I imagine the Pakistan military are kind of like a really high-maintenance but uncommunicative wife who has a track record of quickie divorces from her previous husbands, who are all now buried under a patio.
Pakistan has a long history of military coups. They stage coups like Roger Federer hits tennis balls with a skill and instinct that borders on the routine. They love a coup, Andy. They put them on with the ceremony of royal weddings. And now the tanks roll ceremonially into the streets of Islamabad, and the Prime Minister comes out on the balcony to wave at the angry crowd, his single digits swaying majestically in the hot afternoon air, and yes, there it is. He's been taken from the building. The military's in charge. Inzamam, I will never get tired of seeing this. Just look at those uniforms. Utterly splendid. And up go the machine guns, unloaded now into the air, as is tradition. And the ceremony is complete. We'll see you all back here in 2 years to do it all again. Oh, Pippa.
Was that Inzamam Al-Haq as the co-commentator?
It was, Andy. It was. He wasn't commentating. He was just sitting in his chair doing nothing.
Really? I thought I heard the munch of tooth on cream bun in the background. The no-confidence vote in Prime Minister Gilani was triggered by the expiration of a Supreme Court deadline for the government to reopen political corruption cases. The government had granted an amnesty for politicians in corruption cases. And when a government gives an amnesty for political corruption cases to politicians, that is pretty much as good as wearing an I'm so guilty T-shirt into Parliament.
In fact, one of the leading candidates to take over in Pakistan is Imran Khan, an ex-cricketer. And do you just inherently trust
not just an ex-cricketer, John. He's one of the great legends of the game, John. Don't just describe him as an ex-cricketer.
But do you just inherently trust cricketers a bit more, Andy? Do you think, is there just a part of you which will overlook any potential corruption and just say, well, if you played cricket to test standard, then you know, you should be able to run a country?
I mean, had you asked me that 2 years ago before the massive match-fixing scandal involving Pakistan, I might have said yes. But Imran, by all accounts, is completely untouched by the match-fixing scandal. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I'd like to see, you know, Imran was one of a wave of great all-rounders in world cricket in the late 70s and early 80s, and I'd really like to see them all taking power in their respective countries. I'd like Ian Botham to be King of England. I think Kapil Dev should be running India. And Richard Hadley should be taking over New Zealand and leading them to a great military victory over Australia.
Well, I do hope the six buglers that got those references enjoyed them.
There you go.
Because the rest of us have had to sit through confusion.
And now, to mark this very historic moment in the history of the Bugle, the last ever Times Online Bugle, It's time for the thing you've all been waiting for, Buglers. Finally, after prolonged legal wranglings with the estate of the late John Grisham. He's still alive, isn't he?
No one knows. Are you about to do what I think you're about to do, Andy?
I don't know, John. What, are you expecting me to keepy uppy with a mango for half an hour?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not doing that, John.
What are you doing?
Well, it's just in this very precious manuscript that was delivered to my house just today. The final chapter of the 2011 Unfinished Novel of the Year, The Congressman's Penis.
God, Andy, this is so bittersweet. Now, I wanted the end of this so badly, ever since the start of it.
Yep.
I wanted it to end. And now the fact it's ending on the final bugle, it makes me put a lump in my throat, Andy. I don't know if I want it to end, apart from the fact that I definitely do, so please end it.
Previously, I had the congressman's penis. Some stuff happened and a penis went missing. Final chapter. Mickey Stantonio woke up in his all-too-familiar bed. Home shit home, he thought, regretting having drunk that flagon of unbranded meth the night before. I feel like a slice of lemon in the wrong woman's gin, he growled to his own self. What the f*** am I doing with my life? Sure, being a private investigator beats being a professional pig breeder, but is it really so different? Just then, there was a knock on his door. It was a courier. Package for Stantonio, said the courier. What is it? Said Mickey Stantonio, rubbing a peanut out of his eye. Another burst pillowcase, he thought to himself. Maybe I should try using a conventional one instead of a packet of peanuts. The courier replied, I don't know, but it's postmarked U.S. Congress. Stantonio grabbed the package and incapacitated the courier with a suffocating neck hold. That probably wasn't necessary, he said to himself. Probably doesn't mean definitely in this game. If life was a game of probablys, I'd be living in a cave in Delaware and eating snakes. He carefully opened the package. There, staring at him like a disappointingly unfinished toy cyclops, was a penis. Could this be, he said to his long-departed wife. She didn't reply. At that moment, she was meeting her friend Lorraine for coffee in a cafe in Portland, Oregon, having left Stantonio several years before after an unusually contentious game of scissors, paper, stone. Damn lady. She used to read me like a big print Mills and Boone, he recalled. Stantonio looked the penis in the eye. So, my long-lost friend, we meet again. Whose penis are you and why? He donned his baseball gloves. Never handle a piece of evidence without gloves, he remembered being taught at cop school, along with, don't be too obviously corrupt, and evidence is in the eye of the beholder. Which congressman's penis are you? Suddenly, the penis sat up in his baseball mitt. I'm Newt Gingrich's penis! Look at the f***ing tattoo! It says so on the tattoo! You should have looked at that in chapter one, you f***ing idiot! Could have saved everyone a lot of heartache! Fair point, little Newt, thought Mickey. Can you send me back to Mr. Gingrich, please? He thinks the Soviets have got me, just like they got Lyndon Johnson's penis. The Soviets have Lyndon Johnson's penis, Mickey Stantonio gasped. Then what the f*** was that thing in my lunch yesterday? The end. Well, it's left it nicely open for a sequel about Lyndon Johnson, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
In Bugle 2.1.
So that's it, Andy.
That's it, John. I mean, it's not Grisham's best, let's be honest. It doesn't have quite the same legal rigour. But
can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What happened to everything else that happened in every previous episode?
Well, to be honest, I couldn't remember it, and I didn't have time to look it up.
Yeah, because that seemed to tie up threads that were not left untied and then ignore the other ones, Andy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've probably just been watching too many of your films, John. So that's it. That's the end of the end of two eras.
This is all getting very sad, Andy. It's like the last episode of Cheers, that story.
Yeah.
Now, you basically looked around the bar of the Congressman's Penis story and flicked off the lights. So on the last episode of MASH, you got into a helicopter, took off, looked down, and in stones there was a terribly put together Congressman's Penis on the floor.
Bugle feature section now, and the breakup. Well, breaking up is never easy, I know, as Aristotle himself said, but we have to go due to contractual termination. The times, they are a-changing, as Plato said. They're changing their online priorities and consequently their roster of podcasts. So we're off. It's the big changeover, Buglers.
Mm-hmm.
And the post-op Bugle 179 or Bugle 2.1 should download automatically without you having to resubscribe. But, as we know, history is littered with examples of technology not entirely working as well as might have been ideal, as the passengers on the Titanic would no doubt very wetly testify. Technology letting people down really started with the Big Bang, which frankly could have gone a f*** of a lot better. But hopefully this will not be one of those occasions, and it'll all happen completely seamlessly, and next week's Bugle will just drop into your iPods like a gift from Zeus that it truly is. But if that doesn't happen, then A, don't cry, B, don't panic much, and C, remember that we will still be on iTunes. You can also find us on SoundCloud and at the soon-to-be-revamped website, thebuglepodcast.com. Chris, from a technical point of view, is there anything else Buglers need to know about the big changeover?
Assuming we get it right, no.
Right.
That is a massive assumption. That is a massive... It's going to be an adventure. Yeah. Next week, when you click a button on your computer, it's going to be an adventure. And computers are so effective now that, you know, it takes the thrill out of computing. And we're putting that thrill back in. Because when you press that button, anything could happen. You could get a bugle. You could get a virus of a congressman's penis zooming on. Who knows?
So do look out for it, Buglers. Hopefully it'll work seamlessly. But if not, there's iTunes, SoundCloud, thebuglepodcast.com, the at Hello Buglers Twitter feed, and the Bugle Podcast Facebook page. So we'll still be here. They can't silence us that easily.
Well, we won't still be here. We'll be somewhere else. Yeah. We'll be there. We'll still be there.
Yeah. You just got to make sure that you get there as well. Your emails now, and do keep your emails coming in to info@thebuglepodcast.com, even if those emails are to say the changeover didn't work. What the hell's going on? But a couple of emails came in. Firstly, this one comes in from Miss Sophie, whose email address, curiously, doesn't include the word Sophie at all. And has sent this email to undisclosed recipients, and it says, "Hi, how are you doing? My name is Sophie. Sorry, are you single? I'm searching for serious soulmate. Don't you think we may have some things in common? Let's open communication and see what transpire. I'm waiting for your reply. Sophie." So it does sound like she could be a potential new host for the Bugle.
That sounds good. Well, I tell you what, the safest thing to do, Andy, is to reply to Sophie, including your credit card details and national insurance number, and presume that she'll take it from there.
Yep. And my mother's maiden name.
Yes.
Which, of course, was Ulyanov. This email came in. Now, this is of interest to you, Chris. This email came in from Aaron Sorensen in Dubai, who writes, "Dear Chris, John and Andy, brackets in order of ability to complete a triathlon. I just finished listening to Bugle 177 and heard Chris state that, quotes, if any buglers can beat me in a triathlon, they can attack me how they like.
Oh, shit.
I've done a number of triathlons of varying lengths, including a half Ironman and an Ironman triathlon.
Oh, shit,
well,
you're in trouble, Chris.
Although I'm not world-class by any means, I can guarantee you that Chris has not completed an Ironman triathlon. That's a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile cycle, followed by a full marathon in under 12 hours, as
Holy
I have.
Chris, shit.
It's about speed, not distance. Although I am doing a half Ironman in a couple of months. If he wants to take me on in July, the cow man.
Right.
All right. So I'm sure you can half defeat him.
To be honest, that Ironman is not so much about speed as distance.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's laid that corner down. I'll be competing in the Abu Dhabi International Triathlon on March the 3rd. That sounds hot. And I challenge you to this race. That is, if you're not too much of a fucking pansy. There are three distances, and I'll take you on with the distance of your choice. Until then, all I have to say is, fuck you, Chris.
Wow.
You've been called out, mate.
How expensive is it to get to Abu Dhabi?
Well, run there. Run there. If you're so good at running, Chris.
Oh, shit.
Run, and then swim a bit.
Swim across the channel, then hop on a bike and run the last bit across the desert.
I'm not going to Abu Dhabi unless he pays me.
Right.
You two aren't going to pay me, so...
So do keep your emails coming in, info@thebuglepodcast.com. And so that's it.
That is it.
from the Bugle as a Times Online podcast. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Times Online for hosting and funding us for 4 years and 3 months of the kind of raw-edged investigative journalism that Times founder John Walter always dreamt would grace his publication when he set it up in 1785. Mm-hmm. That is more than five complete days of Bugle in the back catalogue, over 120 hours of hogwash. Mm-hmm. That is more hogwash than our News International colleagues have managed between them at the Leveson Inquiry so far.
Exactly. What would that man years ago, Andy, if he looked forward at News International now, would he be prouder of bullshit or something which is borderline criminal and crossing the border criminal?
Times Online have not been implicated in this.
They've not been. News International, been, Andy, I said News International. Times Online's hands are completely clean.
They've been nothing
but good
They've given me a reason to get up most Friday mornings.
Yeah. Thank you, Times Online.
They've given John the vague sense that he hasn't completely abandoned his motherland in its hour of greatest need.
That's true. So we would seriously like to thank the Times for the last 4 years. 178 Bugles. I think most papers, Andy, would probably have fired us about 177 Bugles ago. So, you know, if nothing else, they've proven they can take a punch.
Yeah. So we'll be back next week with Bugle 179 or 2.1, whichever you prefer. And, we'll take this opportunity to make some much-needed changes. John will be replaced by Lindsay Lohan, and I'll be replaced by the Israeli nuclear whistleblower Mordecai Vanunu, which should be an interesting new dynamic for the show.
Shit, I would really listen to that, Andy.
And Chris is going to be replaced by Steven Spielberg.
Oh, wow!
Yeah, it's going to be huge. And don't forget, if technology does screw up for the first time in its long and illustrious history, find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or the Bugle podcast.com, or just wander around the streets in tears until someone offers to help and explain what the problem is, and they'll take you into their homes and help you rebuild your life. And when the time is right, they'll find the Bugle for you again. We'll meet again. I don't know where, don't know when. But hopefully next week on some kind of audio device.
But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Goodbye, Buglers. See you on the other side.
Farewell. Bon voyage.